Welcome back. The name Dale Carnegie may not be the household name it once was, but his influence is still very much with us. In the 1930s, this native Missourian became one of the most widely read authors in the world with his international bestseller, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Carnegie's blueprint for achieving success is 70 years old. Is it still viable? Some say he unleashed a monster. He's considered the philosophical godfather of those we turn to today for self-help. His story is told in the new book, Self-Help Messiah, Dale Carnegie and Success in Modern America by Stephen Watts, professor of history at the University of Missouri. He is also the author of widely read biographies such a diverse group as Walt Disney, Henry Ford, and Hugh Hefner. Professor Watts joins us from Columbia at station KBIA. Professor, nice to have you with us.
Delighted to be with you.
You know, I think a lot of our listeners may not be quite as familiar with the name Dale Carnegie as they soon will be after reading your book. Why did you choose him as a subject?
Well, I always thought that he was a very influential factor in modern American culture, and I had used his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, in my courses for a number of years. And the book had always prompted a lot of very vigorous discussion among my students. And when I discovered that there had been no biography done of him, it seemed like sort of a natural call for me.
What was it about him that inspired that vigorous discussion?
Well, when I used that book for my students, sort of as a document from the middle decades of the 20th century, there was always a lot of disagreement. About half of the students always liked it quite a bit, and they thought that Carnegie's advice that he unfolded and How to Win Friends sort of opened windows for them, and they understood new things about how to be a kind of vibrant human being. The other half of the class always was rather suspicious of Carnegie's advice, and they thought he was something of a manipulator, I guess, of people. And the debates in class usually got a little on the heated side, but, you know, I figured there's something going on here that needed to be explored.
We'll go into more detail about that advice in a couple of moments, but in a nutshell, what was his basic message?
Well, in How to Win Friends and Influence People, I think Carnegie made a kind of argument that it was not character and sort of inner moral fiber that mattered to be successful in the modern world, but it was more personal development, personality, the ability to handle people in more or less bureaucratic settings in modern bureaucratic life. And that emphasis on personality development, I think, is the key to being successful, was really sort of the gist of his message in the book.
When you talk about the ability to handle people, are we really saying the ability to manipulate people?
Well, that's what the big argument is always about, a kind of a debate over authenticity. With Carnegie himself, having written about him at some length now and gotten to know him, I'm convinced that Carnegie was really quite sincere in his various recommendations about how to deal with other people, having people like you, looking out for their wants and needs and so on as a way to sort of operate in the world. But the problem is that I think not everybody is or was as sincere as Carnegie was about this. And it sort of opens the door to manipulation, I think, by people who can use those tactics in other ways. So it's a kind of ambiguous situation in that way.
Well, as you point out in the book, one of the people who did just that was Charles Manson, the killer of Sharon Tate back in the 60s, Roman Polanski's then wife, and the subject of the Helter Skelter book.
Well, it's got a lot of press lately because that was something of a shocking revelation that Manson apparently got a copy of the book when he was in prison, and it became something of a guidebook for him in how to manipulate people. But, you know, on the other side of the ledger, you have people like Warren Buffett, for example, Lyndon Johnson, Johnny Cash, lots of other folks who took the Carnegie course, read the Carnegie book, and, you know, it helped them in a much more positive way. So I think it's the potential for manipulation that's probably lurking in the shadows there.
Well, Manson certainly is at the opposite end of the spectrum of those you've just mentioned, and the millions of others who have read the book.
Absolutely.
I think it's important that we focus for a bit, before we get to his early days here in Missouri, focus a bit on the time that this book came out, right in the midst of the Depression. And I guess there was a great need for this kind of advice at that time.
Well, I think there was, and the desperation, I think, of the 1930s, when you go back and look at the reception of that book, great enthusiasm for it, I think the depression, desperation clearly lurked in the background. What I found interesting is that the people who most were attracted to it, the people who gobbled it up, were generally sort of lower middle class, so people who had climbed into white-collar jobs, and they were not the people who had lost their jobs or their homes in the Depression, but they were the people who were afraid of that happening, were sort of teetering on the edge. And I think it's those white-collar workers who really responded to Carnegie's message as a way to sort of help them keep their head above water rather than falling into poverty and losing everything they had.
But, of course, that his message was not only well-received here, but around the world. He sold all over the world.
Well, eventually it was. It's sort of astonishing, actually. The various editions of How to Win Friends and Influence People have sold upwards of 35 million copies, paperbacks, of course, after the original editions came out in the 30s. But I think what that's really linked to is really a kind of Americanization of the world in many ways, the kind of globalization of modern social structures and habits and the like that really were rooted in the United States. So I think the Carnegie popularity followed along in that train.
Let's, if we can, and I know we can, trace him from his early days till he reached the point of this great success. The beginnings were quite humble.
Well, very humble indeed. Carnegie grew up in sort of the far northwest corner of Missouri, was born in 1888 and born to a rural family, very, very poor. His father was one of the farmers in the late 19th century who was desperately struggling to survive, and he didn't do it very well. They went bankrupt several times. The family lost their home several times. So very, very poor background. On the other hand, Carnegie's mother was a kind of very enthusiastic and warm person, very religious, was a kind of Methodist lay preacher. And I think Carnegie develops sort of partly in reaction to his father's failure, being so desirous of success. And more positively, he picked up a lot of those personality traits, I think, from his mother that sort of pushed him along as well.
The religious influence on his young life and ultimately on his writing.
Well, I think in his early days, Carnegie as a boy and then as an adolescent, he had been raised in this very strict Methodist sort of background. Dancing, for example, was strictly forbidden in the Carnegie household. His mother would give him books to read like Dancing, The Pathway to Hell, and things like that. And as an adolescent, when he went to college in Warrensburg, Missouri, Carnegie, I think, like a lot of adolescents, sort of reacted rather violently against all of that, and he sort of threw religion over and wanted nothing to do with it. So the religion, in that sense, was not a very strong influence, except as something to react against. But later in life, after his great success, I found it kind of interesting that he returned to religion as a very mature man in his 50s. But he did so in a rather different vein. Religion, as an older man, he found, was a great source of comfort, almost in a kind of therapeutic sense. And he would drop by a church, any kind of religion, and he would meditate. And he found that sort of thinking about the big issues would bring him peace of mind and make him calm and that kind of thing. So it's sort of, in his life, a snapshot of this shift from a stern Protestantism to a kind of therapeutic vision of religion by the middle of the 20th century.
So the religious aspect of his life is absent from How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yes, it's not really there very much at all. You can see little traces, I think, in certain metaphors and formulations, but it's very much in the background.
Interesting that that he went into the sales field in his early adulthood.
Well, he did. Carnegie had first, I think, made a bit of a mark at Warrensburg when he discovered he had a talent for public speaking. I think that, again, comes from his mother's influence. And he sort of had the gift of gab, and he became a very accomplished public speaker in college at Warrensburg. And for him, it seemed kind of a natural shift in young manhood into the sales field, where he could use that gift of gab to sort of operate in this new consumer economy that had developed in the early 20th century. So he made several tries at being a salesman in different fields.
Was he a good one?
Well, sort of. He was extremely successful as a meat salesman working for the Armor Company up in the Omaha area. But he didn't find the work very gratifying, sort of fulfilling in a deeper sense. And he ends up sort of throwing the sales field aside, and he goes east to New York, where he decides he wants to be an actor, where I think, you know, his sort of vocal gifts came into play as well.
Was he a good actor?
Well, apparently a fairly good actor. He went to a leading training academy for actors in New York City that was fairly prestigious. But he also decided that it was not a very lucrative field. It was a very hard one to make a living at. And it sort of launches a kind of roustabout period in his life where he tries the acting. He tries being a car salesman, tries to be a popular journalist for magazines, tries to be a novelist, tries a number of things that don't really work out all that well. And then he finally finds his life's calling as a teacher of public speaking, and that's what really launches his modern career very successfully.
There's a certain irony here, because here's a man who cast about trying to find his way and find out what it was that he was destined to do, and he winds up giving advice to millions of people around the world about how to be successful.
Well, it is, and I think that is a kind of recurring thread, in a way, with the self-help movement that follows in subsequent decades, that a lot of people become very successful by telling other people how to be successful rather than perhaps actually doing it out of the world themselves. So I think there's a certain tradition that he even establishes with that.
I have to take a break here, Professor Stephen Watts. Let's do that now. We're talking with Stephen Watts, the author of Self-Help Messiah, Dale Carnegie and Success in Modern America. We'll come back and pick up on the point you just raised, Professor Watts, in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Professor Stephen Watts in just a moment, but here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon newsrooms following today. A St. Louis Aldermanic Committee is meeting at this hour to discuss the city's snow removal policy. Earlier this month, Francis Slay, the mayor, changed course and ordered side streets to be cleared after considerable feedback from the community. And late last night, inmate Herbert Smalls was executed after the U.S. Supreme Court lifted its stay. Immediately following this program, join us for a live chat at our website, stlpublicradio.org. Our reporter, Chris McDaniel, along with staff from the nonprofit New Orleans news organization, The Lens, will talk about the controversial execution protocols, which are similar here and in Louisiana. And that's a live chat happening after this program at stlpublicradio.org. And join St. Louis Public Radio on the Beacon this afternoon for more local and regional news. And now back to our conversation with Professor Stephen Watts, author of Self-Help Messiah, Dale Carnegie, and Success in Modern America. You know, someone, and I think I alluded to this in my introduction, Professor Watts, said that in a sense, Dale Carnegie might have created a monster. What does that mean, do you think, and do you agree?
Well, I don't think I would put it in quite those terms. In my opinion, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People from the 30s was sort of the founding text of the modern self-help movement, because I think it's still probably the most influential success tract written in the 20th century. And lots of other people, I think from Deepak Chopra, Norman Vincent Peale, Oprah Winfrey, Stephen Covey, all kinds of people have sort of followed in the wake of that with all of the sort of self-help programs that we see so pervasive in our culture in the more modern period. I wouldn't call it a monster, I guess, in my own view, but I think it's a very ambivalent kind of influence in modern culture. I think on the one hand that the self-help tradition has, on the negative side, encouraged a kind of narcissism and emotional self-indulgence, sort of the self-esteem movement run amok. And in my view, there's some negative things definitely that have come out of that for our culture. But on the other hand, I think you sort of have to be fair and recognize that in other ways, I think these movements, including Carnegie, have sort of encouraged a sort of greater sensitivity to the wants and needs of other people in an emotional sense, and sort of, I think, fostered our awareness of happiness and the very complex nature of it emotionally and psychologically. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag. So I wouldn't exactly call it a monster.
Well, one of the interesting things I found in your book is that today's people, both the people that you mentioned, the kind of people you mentioned, and the people on the receiving end of these various messages, seem more interested in self-branding. And you mentioned narcissism.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I think the kind of cultural movement that was created here creates a lot of opportunity for that kind of thing. I think particularly among those who take it in a kind of extreme direction. And it does result in a kind of narcissism, a kind of self-branding, a kind of putting one's emotional needs out there as sort of the most important thing in the world. And, you know, it can lead, I think, to kind of preoccupation with yourself at the expense of broader sorts of concerns and issues. So I do find that aspect of it troubling.
I wonder what he might think were he alive today and watching all of this going on.
Well, that's a very good question, and I think probably my judgment on that would be that his reaction would be mixed. Carnegie himself, he was a very sincere and authentic person, and I think he really meant what he said. I don't think he was a manipulator. I don't think he was a narcissist. So I think the modern self-help movement, he would probably appreciate the positive aspects and be bothered by the sort of negative implications that I was just sort of laying out. That's my best guess anyway.
Sure. Well, it would have to be a guess, obviously. But, you know, you talk about this man and where he was coming from, and if I read it correctly in your book, one of the things that that he said, again, if I read it correctly, was when you tell people that show interest in others, smile, remember names, and that sort of thing, and if you really mean the interest that you have in other people, that is fine. But if you don't really mean it, fake it.
Well, Carnegie, in that regard, I think it's important to remember, comes out of a positive thinking tradition. And it's a kind of tradition that I wouldn't exactly calling it faking it, but it's a kind of tradition where people who follow this line of thought and belief, They believe that if you think positively about the world, if you have positive thoughts about everything, if you mold your behavior in a positive vein, that the world will sort of react to it in a positive way. So I don't think it's so much faking it as a kind of insistence that a positive approach to life, having positive thoughts, is the way to go. And, you know, personally, I have problems with that, but I don't think it's so much faking it as that kind of determination to be positive about the world and treat people in a positive way.
In the midst of the current group of self-helpers, if you will, are Carnegie's books still selling well?
Well, I was fascinated to discover that that book still sells apparently several hundred thousand copies every year. And the Carnegie course is still up and running. It's very vibrant. Thousands of graduates from it in the United States and abroad as well. So I think not only was Carnegie important as a kind of inspiration for all of these other folks, but he himself, I think, still has maintained a presence in our culture in a pretty important way.
The timing of his success, as we have indicated, was clearly very, very important. Who preceded him in this area? Anyone?
Well, the way I lay this out in the early part of my book is that there's a long tradition of success writing in America, of course, and probably the first guy was Benjamin Franklin back in the late 18th century. A penny saved is a penny earned and all of that. And then in the 19th century, it was Horatio Alger with his famous novels about young orphan boys from the countryside who come to the big city and make something of themselves. But those earlier figures really focused on what I call the character ethic, because they argue in one way or another that it's these internalized moral principles, virtue, thrift, kind of prudential way of coming at the world. It's that moral code of character formation that really leads to success. Carnegie changes the game, I think, for the modern world because, as I sort of noted earlier, he talks not about character. He writes in the book, actually, that hard work alone will not get you anywhere in the modern world, but it's personality, personal images, the way that you interact with, the way you appear to other people in this modern bureaucratic setting where you have to get along with others in a teamwork kind of way. It's that personality that's the key. So I think that shift from character to personality is where his significance lay and how it's different from what had come before.
Could you give us a more specific sense of what he advised? I mentioned just some of the obvious ones, and that is, you know, remember people's names, smiled. I read it many, many years ago, and one of the things I remember is if you're having a conversation with someone, talk as much about them and less about yourself, and they'll always remember that as a positive conversation.
Absolutely. The gist of his advice along these lines was to make the other person feel important, listen to them, be a good listener. Try to understand their sort of emotional wants and needs, be perceptive to other people and what they're saying and what they want to do. And Carnegie's basic formulation here is that if you make other people feel important, if you make other people feel that the idea is theirs, that you can, in a very subtle way, sort of assume leadership of a group by treating people in that very respectful sort of fashion. And it's a kind of advice, I think, that actually works very well in sort of working with other people in modern bureaucracies. So I think the way that you summarized it there was very, very close to the nub of the matter.
You know, I wonder in today's world of social media, the digital world, when people are interacting on devices, I just wonder how his message can relate today, really. It just seems like there's this barrier to exactly what he was talking about.
Well, I think that's a very good point. And actually, the Carnegie Company has published a kind of update on the old How to Win Friends book. I believe it's called How to Win Friends and Influence People in the Digital Age. But I think I just kind of glanced at that book, but I think it is directed at just the problem you raise, that in the world of social media, the interactions we have with people tend to be shorter, they tend to be less substantial, they tend to be less involved and, you know, rather superficial. And I think the Carnegie message does sort of get lost in the shuffle with that kind of thing, because you're not interacting with people on social media in the way they did even, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Of all the people that you have mentioned during our discussion, who are the self-help gurus of today, if you will, who would you think is most like him?
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's a good question. Well, you know, in an odd sort of way, although I think she is a little more flamboyant than Carnegie was, Oprah Winfrey is the person that comes to mind, because I think Oprah, in her own way, is a very, very skillful popularizer of this kind of notion of self-development, of personality development, of positive thought, et cetera, et cetera. And I think she demonstrates a kind of capacity to reach people in a way that is very, very effective. People like her. She makes people like her. And, you know, Carnegie was a kind of white, quieter Midwestern guy. And Oprah, of course, obviously is quite different in a number of ways. But I think there's a certain similarity of approach and style there that's kind of interesting.
Of course, he was from a different era, you know, before television, obviously. Did people read him, but did people know him? Was he public in any way so that people on a larger scale could get to know him personally?
Well, after the book came out in 1936, Carnegie became a national celebrity, and all kinds of magazines, for example, like Saturday Evening Post, Look magazine, even sort of ladies magazines like Ladies Home Journal and so on, began to run articles on Carnegie with photographs of him and so on. And he becomes a kind of celebrity in the public sphere in that way. So I think people get to know him a little bit and know about him. But it's also important to note that he remained a teacher. He always considered himself more of a teacher than a writer, and through his entire life, up to his death in 55, he remained very much involved with the Dale Carnegie course, and he traveled the country teaching the course, and after it was franchised to others, he traveled about sort of managing the course, consulting with his teachers, and he became, for people in the Carnegie course, a kind of beloved teacher in that way. So thousands and thousands of people got to know him in that fashion as well.
And, of course, he wrote another book.
Right. In 1948, he wrote a book called How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. And I think it's quite interesting because in many ways that book, which was also a bestseller, not quite as much as the first one, but a very popular book, it was a book addressed, I think, at the very success of How to Win Friends and Influence People, because the second book was aimed at a kind of post-World War II audience of people who had become successful in the growing economy of post-war America, but they weren't happy, sort of middle-class people, very prosperous, pulled out of the Depression, but ironically had not necessarily found happiness with greater material possessions and so on. And the book, the second book, was aimed at that set of problems and issues. So they're linked, I think, interestingly in that fashion.
He must have had, in both occasions, both post-World War II and, of course, during the Depression and prior to World War II, a very keen sense of his time and the kinds of things that were on people's minds.
Well, he did, and I think you put a finger on a key to his own success and popularity. He was not extremely highly educated. He was not a kind of brilliant thinker and writer, but the talent that he did have, he's one of these people, I think, that sort of has their finger on the pulse of the popular culture. He had a kind of impulsive grasp, I think, of what people were worried about, the problems they faced, sort of what the real world was confronting people with. And I think his impulsive, instinctive feel for those kinds of issues, you really see it at work in his writings.
You know, we talked a little bit about those who preceded him. Who influenced him, would you say? Obviously his parents, and you've mentioned his mother and her influence. Who else do you think were the primary influences on him?
Well, I think there are two groups. There is one, a kind of group of positive thinkers who come out of a kind of religious tradition, but also in sort of pop philosophy as well, positive thinking that began to take shape around the beginning of the 20th century. Carnegie read a lot of those kinds of books, popularizations of positive thinking, and I think much like his cohort, Norman Vincent Peale, it sort of pushed him down that road. The other group that influenced Carnegie quite a bit were psychologists. And I think in my book I make a big deal about Carnegie and sort of the popularization of psychology in modern American culture. He reads a lot of popularizers of Freud and Adler and William James and the like. He is very much attuned to certain people who are moving in the circles of Harry Stack Sullivan, that kind of psychology as well. And you see a very strong psychological influence in his writing. He defines himself in How to Win Friends, for example, as being a practical psychologist. And he defines many of his principles and suggestions as being psychological techniques for understanding people and how and why they do the things they do. So I would say the positive thinking people and the psychologists were the two big groups that influenced him.
We are talking about Dale Carnegie, the godfather of the self-help movement, as some people have called him. My guest is Stephen Watts, author of Self-Help Messiah, Dale Carnegie, and Success in Modern America. Professor Watts, I'd like to just change direction a little bit, if you don't mind on this, because I'd like to talk to you very briefly about some of your other books and this very diverse group of people whose biographies you have written, Henry Ford, Walt Disney, and Hugh Hefner. Could you give me kind of a thumbnail of each of these gentlemen as you found them?
Right. Well, I think all of my biographies, and in hindsight, well, I would like to take credit for some grand plan, but it wasn't quite like that. I think it was more half-conscious. But I think they're all major figures in modern American culture who contributed important things to defining what I see as sort of the dominant culture of the modern period, a kind of consumer culture of self-fulfillment, I think I would call it. And what you see with the four people that I've written about, I think, are people who contribute to that in various ways. With Disney, you had someone in the entertainment field and sort of the branding and marketing field who very much pushes this along. With Henry Ford, you had the creator of the first great consumer item, I think, in modern America, the Model T automobile, and sort of visions of the good life that come from that. With Hefner, of course, you see the prophet of sort of self-fulfillment in capital letters, I think, in his particular case, with Playboy magazine in the post-war world. And then with Carnegie, what you have is the great success writer of the 20th century, I think, that fits into that larger paradigm as well. So what I've been exploring, I think, in all of these books are how these figures sort of are engaged in creating that larger whole. And right now, if I can add, I'm writing a book on John Kennedy and sort of the politics of celebrity in modern America, which I think is yet another dimension of that larger whole as well.
I would almost have to wonder what yet could be said about John Kennedy. So much has been written about him.
Well, that's a good question people often ask. Well, basically what I'm trying to do is to look at Kennedy as a cultural figure rather than a political figure, because I've become convinced that the source of his popularity and significance really doesn't have a whole lot to do with politics, and it has a lot to do with cultural image and certain kinds of cultural images that he projected in the arena of politics. So I'm sort of trying to do with Kennedy what Gary Wills did with Nixon and Nixon Agonistes, and look at him as sort of a cultural figure first, a political figure second.
One of the things that strikes me, though, about Kennedy is the image that he projected during the course of his presidency and before, and the image that we have of him following his assassination more recently as revelations have come to the fore about his womanizing and things like that. He was quite a different person than people knew him during his presidency, for instance.
Well, that's true, of course. But one thing I've been exploring is precisely that, the kind of womanizing, the details of which, of course, we know a lot more about now. But what I found fascinating in the 50s is that almost from the very beginning, as Kennedy's rising to success, he appears and is framed as a kind of movie star candidate with enormous sex appeal. And reporters who knew about his activities behind the scenes, of course, in those days would not write about them. But what you see in the descriptions of Kennedy in newspapers and magazines and news accounts and the like is a kind of sublimated version of movie star with great sex appeal, his appeal to women, et cetera, et cetera. So even at the time, I think it comes out in very interesting ways and helps create the kind of image that swept him to success in 1960.
We will certainly look forward to your latest book on John Kennedy. One other area I'd like to touch upon, because there is a Missouri connection with Walt Disney, who lived here for a period of time. He came here, I think, at the age of 10. But there's renewed interest in him right now because of the movie that is currently receiving a lot of acclaim. What kind of a guy was Walt Disney? I think we get mixed messages about him as well.
Well, Walt Disney was a very complicated guy, I would say. I think the image of Uncle Walt that at least people my age got from television as a kid when he hosted all of the Disney shows the kind of avuncular figure who was chuckling a lot and eager to have children learn, happy and friendly, and someone very sort of immersed in this gentle creativity. I think there's a part of Disney that was very much like that, very genuine. The Uncle Walt thing rings pretty true. But of course, as with everybody, there was other sides to him as well. In that he was a very stern sort of taskmaster. He demanded a lot of the people who worked for him. He demanded a lot of himself. And I think under the pressure of events, under the pressures of actually completing creative work, he could be a kind of difficult man to work for. He was often called the wounded bear, for example, by some of his employees, because he could be difficult, and he had his moments when people did not see the Uncle Walt everyone else saw, but a much more demanding guy. So I think he's a complicated man, a very interesting man.
As so many people are, and certainly people who achieve the top of their field. I mean, we can look at Henry Ford too, and the impact he had on this society is enormous. And yet, there's this great negative, the anti-Semitism that we're hearing so much about lately.
Right, and I think with all these very high-achieving people, Ford and Disney and Hefner as well, I would throw in there. There's sort of one side of them that is very kindly and open and creative, and on the other hand, they're also very driven individuals. They're driven to succeed. They have a vision of what they want to do that come hell or high water they will realize. So I think all of these high achievers in that sense have that kind of ambiguity about them.
I wonder if any of these gentlemen ever read Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I'm I don't think Hefner has, nor Ford. And I was trying to think, Dale Carnegie wrote a couple of, when he was doing a newspaper column, he wrote a couple of columns about Walt Disney and his success as being an exemplar of Carnegie's principles. But I don't remember that going the other way. I don't recall any evidence that Disney had read Carnegie and imbibed all of that.
Well, we've connected some of those dots in any case.
Indeed.
Let me mention for our audience, we've been talking about Henry Ford, Walt Disney, and Hugh Hefner. The books by our guest, Stephen Watts, are Henry Ford and the American Century, Walt Disney and the American Way of Life, and Hugh Hefner, Mr. Playboy, Hugh Hefner and the American Dream. Of course, we've spent most of our time today talking with Stephen Watts about his latest book, Self-Help Messiah, Dale Carnegie and Success in Modern America. Thank you so much, Stephen Watts, for being with us, and we look forward to the latest book on John Kennedy.
Well, it's been great to talk with you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll unveil the nominations for St. Louis Theater Circle Awards, which honor the best actors and artists in local professional theater. He'll also talk with drummer Mike Heidorn about the re-release of the Uncle Tupelo recording, No Depression. And he'll take a look at Upstream Theater's production of the Australian play, Forget Me Not. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with the interim chancellor of St. Louis Community College. And a reminder to join us right now at stlpublicradio.org for a live chat about Missouri's controversial execution protocol after inmate Herbert Smalls was put to death last night. The controversy is similar in Louisiana, and we have partnered with the New Orleans nonprofit news organization, The Lens, for this live online conversation. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Amanda Huntingfort, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.